This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. To set the stage for this next piece, bike lanes have entered into the conversation recently here in Prince George amidst online discourse and through the city's official community plan survey as one of the potential priorities to be identified. That alongside accessibility and infrastructure, to name just a few things present on the survey. These, though, are heavily interrelated. To break that down for us today, I separately spoke with Dr.
My name is Rylan Graham, and don't know if you need my title, but assistant professor in the School of Planning and Sustainability here at UNBC.
And Dr.
My name is Mark Grew. Probably the most formally recognized role is as an associate professor in the School of Planning and Sustainability.
Before we dive into our explanation, I need to summarize the concept of universal design. Universal design is the design and composition of an environment so that it can be accessed, understood, and used to the greatest extent possible by all people, regardless of their age, size, ability, or disability. An environment or any building, product, or service in that environment should be designed to meet the needs of all people who wish to use it. This is not a special requirement for the benefit of only a minority of the population. It is a fundamental condition of good design. If an environment is accessible, usable, convenient, and a pleasure to use, everyone benefits. By considering the diverse needs and abilities of all throughout the design process, universal design creates products, services, and environments that meet people's needs. Simply put, universal design is good design. Universal design and accessibility are two concepts already coupled together. But can bike lanes, a method of transportation, be considered together with them? We bring you to Mark Grew for analysis.
I don't believe that those two things should be thought about in separate ways. But at the same time, I don't know that it would hold that if we are to plan for cycling, that we inherently are enhancing things from a universal design perspective. The reason I think I share those views is we might want to focus a little bit more broadly on the concept of different forms of mobilities, as we often do and have for a long time in the urban planning profession. Particularly in northern cities, we have a lot of our infrastructure related to mobility dedicated to the concept of automobility. We've been accommodating the automobile in the way that we promote movement through our cities since particularly the end of World War II and the post-war era. Most of our infrastructure has been built to accommodate the automobile and movement by the automobile. That is particularly true in a lot of northern cities and communities. So we are lacking in terms of infrastructure, dedicated infrastructure that supports different forms of mobilities like cycling, movement by different forms of pedestrian mobility that could be walking, could be wheeling. There is, I think, a very important intersection to be examined in terms of how we can expand the variety of ways that we move through our communities and incorporate universal design thinking as we try and expand those modes of movement in our communities. Because at the end of the day, the notion of universal design is all about designing communities that meet the needs of all individuals and what they bring to a situation. And not everyone is bringing a vehicle. Not everyone is bringing upright ambulatory embodiment of space. We need to be thinking more broadly about the population who lives in our communities that we are planning with and that we're responsible to.
Before we consider making changes to this landscape and whether or not we would want better bicycle infrastructure, is what we currently have good enough? Can people effectively and safely commute? Can people on bicycle participate in the local economy? We turn to Dr. Rylan Graham for an answer.
There's definitely room for improvement. I would say that our network, if we're looking at cycling infrastructure, is totally insufficient, actually. And if I can offer an anecdote, you know, I moved to Prince George about 3 years ago, and I moved from Calgary, and I lived in Calgary for many years. And my latter years in Calgary, I actually didn't own a car, and I relied on walking, I relied on transit, I relied on my bike to get around, right? And those were my primary modes of moving throughout the city. And then when I, knew I was moving to Prince George, I thought, okay, maybe I can continue this sort of this approach to mobility. Mm-hmm. But upon arriving in Prince George, it became quite clear that this is not a city that's been designed or developed for alternative modes of transportation. And by that, I mean cycling, walking, or transit. It is indeed quite difficult to live here car-free or even car-light. You are, and we are, as a city, quite dependent on the automobile in the city. So there's great room for improvement, significant room for improvement in terms of how do we make these other modes of transportation possible and efficient and options that people actually will and can use.
By Dr. Graham's description, it would seem that we are behind the ball as it pertains to bicycle infrastructure. But the bicycle was invented well before the automobile. So how did we get to the point where we're at now? On that is Dr. Mark Grew.
One way to address that is to look back at the history of the different kind of spatial frameworks that we have used to plan our communities, and particularly the role and interest, I suppose, that certain types of technologies have played in shaping those types of spatial frameworks. And many of the spatial frameworks like City Beautiful, the Neighborhood Unit, which was popularized by Clarence Perry, were very interested in accommodating a new form of mobility technology that was emergent and growing at the time, which was the automobile. So as we see different frameworks like the Neighborhood Unit come into play in planning, become popularized, become used more and more in city planning, included very directly in places like our city of Prince George, accommodating the automobile is kind of put at the center of an assumption about how people should move through communities and how people will continue to move through communities. And of course, we've seen over time, there's a tremendous amount of externalities that come with that, particularly related to greenhouse gas production, issues related to sustainability, issues related to physical health, a whole range of different, perhaps unanticipated and unwanted consequences.
With Mark's summation of the establishment of the automotive infrastructure in mind, this then begs the question, what is the best way to pragmatically introduce successful bicycle infrastructure in our community, knowing that there's going to be a significant upfront cost? Dr. Mark Grew does have some thoughts on that.
Part of answering that question practically and pragmatically, I think, requires situating some of our development history in the city of Prince George. So we look at the population growth of our city. Immediately or closely following the end of World War II, the population of Prince George is like under 6,000 people, due in large part to the strength of the regional resource economy. The city attracts and grows in tremendous ways. By the time we hit 1980, we're about 67,000 people as a community. And we've only added a few thousand in the ensuing decades since then. So part of the answer to that question is realizing that what we are struggling to address in terms of urbanization, multiple modes of mobilities, denser, more mixed-use development, creating walkable, wheelable communities, is a lot about addressing some of the kind of lock-in and legacy that we have been left with from a period of rapid expansion that was accommodated through forms of planning and development that mostly were designed around automobility. And we still have those today because the pace of development, the pace of investment and growth in the city since 1980 hasn't been large enough or significant enough to really recapitalize major changes in terms of our urban form. Because of that, the pace of development and growth probably would suggest that a pragmatic approach is to have a very clear vision of where we want to go. That's what the OCP and follow-up neighborhood scale plans are meant to provide us as a community, but recognize that we have to work really closely as a community, as a local government, and work with the private sector who does the building to incrementally grow ourselves towards a more sustainable vision that includes some of these very common practices like mixed-use development, incorporation of dedicated cycle infrastructure that we see being used across Canada, including in a number of northern cities, places like Whitehorse.
Dr. Ryland Graham helps us conceptualize how we might be more easily able to swallow the cost of investment over time.
There is often some, you know, opposition or questioning of investment when it goes into, let's say, you know, cycling infrastructure. But, you know, where there is sort of that questioning or opposition, we don't tend to do that when it comes to car-based infrastructure, which is actually quite a bit more expensive, right?
Right.
And so, but there does seem to be this cautious approach to building cycling infrastructure here in the city and typically, you know, in most Canadian cities, right? Prince George suffers some of the similar sort of challenges that other Canadian cities do. So there is certainly this upfront cost that comes with, you know, improving the infrastructure. But also I would argue that, and the evidence research data suggests, by investing in these other modes of transportation that, okay, well, there is actually cost savings longer term. And we can think of the cost savings in a variety of different ways, right? Encouraging people to take or use their bike is better for the environment, as an example, right?
Right.
I mean, reduces to no emissions compared to creating a society that's very dependent on the automobile. So, you know, there are costs with having a society that is dependent on the automobile that, you know, if we start to shift at least some proportion of our daily trips towards cycling, there are these cost savings. And we see that, you know, through the sort of environmental impact, but also if we're talking about, you know, the costs of infrastructure, well, you know, there's a significant cost to creating a society or city where we have lots of really big, heavy, large vehicles on the road that causes quite, you know, the wear and tear on our infrastructure, our roads. Whereas, you know, cycling, you can imagine, does not create the same wear and tear on our roads. So despite whatever capital costs might go into building the infrastructure in the first place, there are absolutely longer term savings that come by investing in these alternative modes. Again, not just the economics, but for the environmental health, for human health, investing in cycling infrastructure pays dividends in so many ways that might not be obvious up front. But if we actually stop and think about it, we realize that actually it's a really great investment.
But are there economic benefits to, say, the commercial side of thing or the industrial side of things? Is there any economic benefit to Prince George to implement this type of transportation?
Yeah, if we think that the municipality, the city, is on the hook or it's their responsibility to maintain infrastructure, again, if we've created a city where everybody has to drive, that again creates a real significant wear and tear on our streets. And so then we have a city that is having to renew that infrastructure a lot more frequently, where again, cycling, walking, or shifting to transit, you know, reduces the wear and tear on our roads, right? And there is also benefit to private businesses as well. There's been some research that's come out that shows putting in a bike lane on a street actually has a positive economic impact on the businesses that are there. So for example, I just read a report yesterday that was from New York City, and whether it was last year or a couple of years ago, but they essentially took a sort of strategy to pedestrianize a bunch of streets. So closing off the streets to traffic and making them great spaces for people, which I presume cyclists could also enter into. And they saw that it was in the either hundreds of millions or billions in terms of the increased spending that occurred by pedestrianizing those streets. Because again, you're creating a space that is more welcoming to people. You know, cars aren't shopping at businesses, it's people. And so if you're creating spaces, places for people, you're going to attract them and they're going to go and they're going to spend more money at local businesses.
Again, with so many places in North America and the world facing a rising number of aging population, developing adaptations and improvements for aging in place, universal design, accessibility, and even bike lanes appear to be integral to developing a community where not just an aging population can participate in, but everyone. To conclude, I asked Dr. Mark Grew, are we on track to doing that, or are we locked in the status quo?
If I get back to the notion of, do we have the kind of present ideas and frameworks in our city of Prince George that we should be working with to promote this idea of aging in place, to promote and grow Prince George as a welcoming place to think about retiring and living a very fulfilled life in kind of latter years for individuals. We have in place the right policy tools. We've had in place for a number of years an age-friendly community plan, very much in line with a global movement from the World Health Organization about how we can design and develop cities, whether it's our public transit infrastructure to our housing, both from a physical design and an affordability perspective, to meet the needs of seniors, and often in doing so, meet the needs of a far broader range of folks in our community. And a lot of this started with the notion of 8 to 80 cities, that designing for older adults also helps to meet the needs of families, helps to meet the needs of children. So we do have, I think, the right tools in play, the right ideas in play to move forward on that. It's going to be, I think, a very important thing for our official community plan, and I suppose this is me addressing more directly the question, to think about how that fits into the broader vision and trajectory for our community. At the end of the day, while an official community plan serves many, many different regulatory purposes, policy purposes, what it really is in a very distinct way for a community and a municipality is meant to be a shared and collective vision for where we should be heading. So the extent that we incorporate some of these ideas and try and capitalize on some of our policy tools like our age-friendly community plan, some of that might start with how our vision that is coming together through this official community plan review process captures and recognizes some of the things that we've been talking about in our city for the last decade.
We've been talking to Drs. Mark Grew and Rylan Graham of UMBC's School of Planning. By the sounds of it, folks, the future is in your hands. If you're interested in seeing investment in local infrastructure, speak to your city councilors, attend city open houses, and fill in the citywide surveys as the opportunities arise. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program.